everyone. On today's episode is a dreamer herself, Jewish born, who fell in love with French and became an outsider. But today she touches lives of other people by giving them the voice through a language. Please meet Suzanne.
Let me track back and talk a little bit about your connections and how you settled in this country. Because every time when you talk about somebody, you say, they're like family to me. They're like family to me. And I realized that I don't really know your journey in the United States. I just heard the pieces from what you were telling me, but we never actually talked about it. So how your journey started in the United States?
Well, you know, there are a couple pieces I want to put together. I was born here, but when I started learning French when I was in third grade, I was 8, and I just fell in love with that. And I think that was my dream. My American dream took place in France in terms of feeling free. And I'll come back to that. But the American dream that my students have and that other immigrants and refugees that have been in my life have had really crisscrosses with my own way of living and my own identity and my own, really my own wish for people to be able to be safe. And perhaps it's because I wasn't always safe. I don't know. I mean, I was a little girl, so I there was nothing conscious. Obviously, you know, you live your life, and when you're a child, you each day, you know, you just live your life. Right. And yet I always, the pieces that really matter to me are that people be safe and that people have a voice and feel love and feel confident. And really, Anya, that has transferred into all of my teaching, all my friendships, my friends in France and in Japan and Israel and here, and, you know, teaching English as a second language. I have a second language and a third language, so I know what it's like to lose and to move on, and also to become a part of another culture. So I think when I say that I have a family in France and a family in Japan, and family in Quebec, and family here and family in Israel, those are the pieces that make me feel complete and also make me feel like I can be a family as an individual, but as an individual that feels so connected to other cultures and wants to be. And that's what I want to give to people. It's really my dream.
And I know you're very passionate about it. I remember you sent me the video on YouTube, Suzanne the Dreamer.
Yeah.
And I realized how really passionate you are about it. And where is this passion coming from? Being born and raised in the United States and basically adopting this mentality, but at the same time, from working with you and how we met and talking to you, I see this passion for helping immigrant population in this country. And like you say, supporting people, supporting refugees, making sure that they have their voice. Where is this coming from?
You know, it's coming from within me, but within me planted by my parents who were always open. We always knew their friends. My mom's best friend growing up escaped from Nazi Germany through an aunt who was in France who knew an aunt here. And she ended up as a teenager living next door to my mom. So Ruthie's always been in my life. She's 98 now, and she's just so dear to me. And as a little girl, of course, I didn't know her story. I know it now as an adult, but she, you know, it's my parents, my parents' best friends, Hendy and Ruthie, were always part of my life. And as an adult, I was able to forge friendships with them as me, not as my parents' daughter, but via being my parents' daughter. And the same with my dad. My dad was in the Air Force, and all his best friends were in the Air Force. And I remember on Sundays, we used to go sometimes to O'Hare used to have an Air Force base. It's closed now. And every Sunday we would get together with his Air Force friends, and they were also so close to us, and they were like brothers to my dad. And I remember every second Saturday of May is what's called Armed Forces Day in the United States. And a lot of people don't know about it. It's on a calendar, but unless you live it, you really don't know. And we always went, and it was at O'Hare at the Air Force Base, and we could go inside planes, and the parents would get together and talk, and, you know, sometimes talking Air Force business and sometimes talking family love and their activities. You know, these were solid friendships. And there was a man who was named Tiny, and Tiny was huge. He was huge. And as a little girl, he was bigger than life. And Tiny would occupy us kids while our parents at Armed Forces Day got to hang around and schmooze together and talk. And it was so wonderful. And there was a player piano. And a player piano is magic to anybody, but as a kid, and seeing Tiny play it and then let us try to push on the pedals, which was so hard as a little girl. Sure. And one night, I was, let's see, it was in the 60s, maybe in 65, 66, 67. My dad called us three kids into their bedroom and took us to the corner window, and the colors of the walls were chartreuse, and there were two windows. And I don't know if my mom was in the room or not, I don't remember, but we three kids were. And my dad said, "I have something important to tell you kids." And he told us that Tiny got shot in Vietnam and died.
Wow.
And every night on the TV in America in those days, you saw the Vietnam War. It was what they call America's first TV war. So we knew about it. And I'll never forget that. I can picture us at the next to the green wall. And when my dad passed away 9 years ago, I found a letter dated September 16th, 1966. Okay. Dear Ralph, welcome to from the land of summer and rain, dust and mud, snakes and things. I am sure sorry I didn't get to see you before I left in May. But you know how it is trying to see all your relatives before you go. As a veteran from the big war in 17 and the skirmish in 42, I'm sure you'll understand. And then he talks about where he was stationed. And then I'm still trying to get to O'Hare. Well, how are things at home? Fine, I hope. How are the wife and children? I'm still trying to get to O'Hare. I just sent my application in yesterday. Do they still have a program at O'Hare? If I get my special assignment in the Air Force, will have me for another 4 years. If I don't get it, I'll retire 8 months after I hit the States. Give my regards to Ted and Masa, Mike. Mike built our house that I grew up in.
Nice.
And the rest. Tell them to rest easy that I am over here. Well, Ralph, I'll knock off for now. I hope that this little note finds you and yours in the best of health, right when you can find time, the little one, Tiny. And Anya, I had never seen this letter before. I didn't know about it, but it's just all connected to how so much of what I grew up with was. And so I wasn't even really aware until right now, that all of this made for my feeling of connectedness to other people.
Interesting, interesting. So you saw this letter for the first time when your father passed away?
Actually, I didn't. I took a bunch of his letters and all that, and I stuffed them in his little nightstand, which is in my living room. And I only about 2 or 3 months ago decided to look inside the drawer. So after 9 years of having this stand that was my grandparents' stand.
Wow.
And it's really pretty. It's got a little drawer and in it are some photos and then this letter. And it's when I saw who the return address was from, I thought, oh my gosh. So I had this letter for 9 years really.
And today, and then, is the day to make it public and to read it.
I guess. In his honor and in honor of, you know, all the dreamers from wherever they are, be it you, be it Maria, be it Dima, be it whoever my friends are and my students and the students that I've never met yet that I want to meet and I want to help. I want to help them realize that they've already, all the immigrants or refugees who have come here, all of them have already done the hardest thing in their lives that they'll ever do. And I tell that to every group because it's true. They've already left their home and come somewhere new, come somewhere unknown. And I tell them, you don't have to be afraid now. You've already done the hardest thing, you know, and the hardest thing. And that needs to be able to, that idea and that memory of accomplishing and taking a risk needs to really be in their blood and heart all the time so that they're not scared of what's going on in our world, which is hurting so badly now and has always hurt in different ways and similar ways too. And it's just, I tell them, you've already done what's hard. You can have confidence. And I always teach them and remind them that in 2008, when Obama said, si se puede, yes, I can, that his words will ring forever in my life and in the words, the lives of so many other people. And I tell that to my students and I say, you know, you have a voice. You need to use your voice. And now you're learning to use your voice in another language. Yes, so it's so not even easy to use your voice in your native language. And here you are, you know, and you need to believe in yourselves. And I say that all the time in different ways in every class and in my tutoring and volunteering. And it's just, it's so important. It is so important.
Absolutely. And confidence, I think this is the most difficult thing to obtain, especially when we work with refugees, with immigration population, uh-huh. because the mindset, that's my thinking, and I'm thinking about my experience. And you are right. And when you say that you have done already a lot, like people tell me you've traveled here 6,000 miles away from Siberia to the United States, that's already a big step. And I hear Jay's words, and you met Jay. He says exactly the same things. This is huge. But don't you think that, yes, we understand it's a big step on the first place, but the mindset, the mentality that we bring, people bring, this is the most difficult thing to work on.
And oh, I agree.
I'm just curious, do you have any tips or any advice, or maybe you do something special when you try to change this mentality of population that you are working with? How do you build this confidence?
That's a really great and powerful, touching question, Anya. Part of what helps me to at least share this idea and offer my energy and offer courage to my students and to friends, because many have become friends and are really part of the fabric, the weaving of my life. You know, thinking about a weaving, the Navajo women are weavers, as are many other groups of people around the world, but the Navajo women always leave one thread of their weaving, of their rug, whether it's small or large, they always leave one thread that is not woven in. And their belief is that that thread will lead to the next weaving or lead them to connecting to the next weaver whom perhaps they will teach, like their grandma or mother or sister or aunt or friend taught them. But it's that idea of the thread leading to someone and something else. And a weaving is never the same. A weaving is always created by the weaver, can change midstream, can change in one row because of an idea, because of missing, forgetting what she was going to do. It's mostly women who weave, at least for Navajo. And And I think of life like that, at least my life, and I want that to be how my students and friends can live. It's the connection that's leading to someone else, to something else. It's part of a dream. It's that long stream. And some people who have looked, I've heard this from weavers, some people look at the weavings and say, well, there's an error, there's a mistake, that one thread isn't woven in. And when you know the story, it's exactly the power of the weaving. It's not, I think, the idea of completing the weaving. It's the fact that it's part of the stream of life. And it's not always conscious. It's just important. It's vital. It's the lifeline. It's the creativity that's been passed on. And when I tell my students, you know, when I lived in France 3 years, I went as a student first. So I had papers, in quotes. And then I returned to teach English in Paris. And I had papers. I had a job. I had a piece of paper that said I could apply for an apartment. And I was, quote, safe. And I needed to do it by myself, and with the help of my friend Françoise, especially, who was the first French woman I ever met in my life. She housed me at the beginning and she believed in me, but I know now that my journey was different than that of my students because I had papers. I was given papers. I didn't realize at the time, of course, how important this was, but I always tell them, you know, I had papers, but I didn't know the importance. I didn't know what that meant. I had to meet you all and live longer and live more and hear other stories to really understand what you're going through. And I remember standing in line waiting to get my little card for to be able in Paris to get an apartment. I had a studio that was as big as my table and outside toilet and everything. And I think I told you that I wrote to my mom so proudly that didn't have a fridge, and I was so proud because I had a basket on my window and the pigeons pooped on it. I kept my yogurt that I bought every day, and I was so proud. And my mom contacted
me. That's a big achievement.
Yeah, I was thrilled. I felt French, you know?
Yeah.
And my mom contacted Sears here, which was an appliance store. It's now closed, but and called to see how she could send me a fridge in Paris. And oh my gosh, when I heard that, I wrote back and I said, please don't. I mean, to me, it represented taking away my beauty of my French life. Anyhow, when I was waiting in line for this piece of paper, it was about 4 or 5 in the morning, pitch dark in the fall. So early morning darkness. I was standing, I was the only woman in this long line that I saw. And there were a bunch of guys from North Africa who were French citizens because France was their colonizer, hence they were French. And I was talking to the guy in front of me in the dark, and he showed me his picture. And I said, oh. And he said, where's your picture? And I said, I don't have one. What do you mean? He said, well, you have to have a picture to be able to get into this, you know, office to get your permission card, your carte de séjour that permits you to stay and have housing. You have to have a picture for this. In France, you need a picture for everything. And I said, it was 4 o'clock in the morning. And he said, I'll save your place. And he gave me some coins because I didn't have anything. And I had my passport, that was all. And he told me to go up the hill, and it was about a kilometer or so away. But he said, you've got 4 or 5 hours till the place opens. And he told me what to do to sit in a photo booth. And I still have the picture.
Wow.
Because you had to get 4 pictures, you know, out of the machine for your franc or whatever it was. And had he not helped me? So, and I didn't know. And I was shy at the time and I had no idea.
Absolutely.
And so I was just like my students. And it was 4 in the morning with another immigrant. And he saved me. Otherwise, I'd have gotten there and probably gotten scolded by some functionary because I didn't know. So how do you scold someone who doesn't know? You can't do that. Yes. You need to show them and teach them and lead them and take their hand and help them to cross that bridge. And that's what this man did to me.
And I'm glad you said this, because not many people understand this. And I was kind of the victim of this as well. When I moved to Chicago, I didn't know that a car is supposed to have a city sticker.
Yeah.
And I...
How would you know, right?
I got a ticket. So I got a ticket for something that I didn't know. And I don't know if you know, but when you get the letter, when you get the actual ticket in the mail, they give you several options. You can pay online, you can send a check in, or you can appeal the ticket. And I'm having all these thoughts. Should I pay and just save my time and forget about it? Or should I make a point? So after debating for a while, I'm deciding to appeal this ticket.
Good for you.
And I went to the court. And the court was a tiny place somewhere on Lawrence, I think, that area. And it was just myself and the judge. And when I got into the tiny hearing room, and the judge listened to me, the reason why I was there. And you know what he told me.
What?
Ms. Enright, unfortunately, you have to pay. And I said, but how can I be punished for something that I wasn't aware of? And when he said, oh, you should have asked your friends or your neighbors or people around.
Holy cow.
I just looked at the judge and I said, Your Honor, I will pay the ticket. And I just left. And I felt so bad that somebody with authority, the judge, tells me things like this.
Yeah.
I would expect to hear something, oh, Ms. Enright, I'm sorry, we didn't send you the letter. I'm sorry you were not aware of this. And the first time will be okay. That's how it works in the United States. The first time you might not know, and we forgive you. The second time, excuse me, let's figure out why.
Yeah. But
when he told me this, I was shocked. I couldn't believe my ears. And I realized, okay, so I'm probably better off to pay this ticket. I totally hear you. How can you be punished for something that you don't know, being new in the country?
Right.
That's why what we're doing, educating our students or people, I always say students, but I think these are people that come to this country for the opportunities and they contribute to this country. And I feel like between me and you and how we met, this is our mission, because we
Absolutely.
Choose to do this.
Yeah.
And this is so wonderful. And this is so great. Another thing, when I was listening to your story about the letter that you found, and I'm thinking about the technologies, and you know how I love technologies, and I love the benefit of technologies. And now you are falling onto the same path. And when I think about the letter, and I say, okay, what if it's an email and you would never find this letter?
Right.
But it's a handwritten letter that you found in your father's
notes. Here it is.
Yeah. Look at the handwriting.
Yeah.
It's just fascinating. It's just mind blowing.
Yeah.
The power of a handwritten letter and the power of technologies, what we're living through right now. And you represent it. It's wonderful. It's great. Yeah,
thanks. And, you know, I've saved so many letters. My stepmom saved all my letters from when I lived in France. And I never knew that, Anya. And one day she handed me a box, a stationery box, which nobody even knows what it looks like anymore, a blue stationery box that I have upstairs. And she said, here, Susan, this is for you. And I didn't know what it was. And she said, open it. And it was all my aerograms and all my letters and postcards that I had sent to them. She saved.
Wow.
I couldn't believe it. I hugged her. I cried. I thanked her. And I have saved the family letters from my French adopted family and my French friends, and from Pauline, my first Quebecoise friend. I have everything. And yesterday I took a photo of a t-shirt that Pauline had given me when she ran for office, and she gave it to me and I took a photo. I wear it a few times a year so it'll last. This t-shirt is old. We've known each other 30 years.
Wow.
And, or more, I don't know. We met in Mexico because we both wanted to learn Spanish. And Pauline introduced me to Quebec. And Pauline introduced me to the Quebec of her dream and of her fight and of her mission to become an independent country, not through war, but through identity. And that led to me doing my doctoral work and meeting musicians and poets who had the same dream, who had the same dream. And she is the one who trusted enough in our friendship and introduced me to what was really her gut. In French, we say les tripes. It's like your innards.
Right.
Like nobody can touch your tripe, like no one can take out your heart. And that's what Pauline did for me and continues doing for me. And it's following all on the path of learning French, of becoming a part of my French family and friends' culture and families of four generations and of tears and of laughters and mosquitoes and camping and my first oysters and being so scared and, you know.
So many memories.
Yeah, but, and there's a song that my first Quebec musician whom I met, Georges Do, wrote, and it's called Je suis Québécois, I am Québécois. And it says, I am Québécois, but I don't know why, maybe for nothing, maybe to laugh, maybe waiting till we are no longer here. I'm Québécois. What does that give me? I often ask myself, what? And then it goes on and he says, I could have been a little Chinese guy, but what would that have changed? It's difficult to be oneself and to let others be themselves. It's difficult among all kinds of things. What is it to be me? What is it to be me? It is being me and to stay Québécois. And the other day, you and I were talking about heritage and keeping our languages alive and keeping our traditions alive. And I see in America now people wanting to squelch that with newcomers. And newcomers can be here for 45 years, but they came from somewhere else. And I just really believe in that we all need to keep our languages. We need to keep our traditions and the recipes. How my grandma made borscht, I don't know. I want to know. I want to learn at least how to do it because I know she did and I remember loving it. I remember hearing her voice saying it, you know, and it's those traditions that for me, I try to share with my friends and my students so that they then can add to their tradition treasury and do it, add that to their lives, add a different twist, add a different story. You know, it's all through love.
Absolutely.
It's all through love. And in English, the word foreign and foreigner has often a very negative connotation. Like you can say, I have a foreign object in my eye and my eye hurts. And I have thought about this for years thinking, wow, in French, it's étranger, étrangère. It can mean strange, it can mean foreign, it can mean foreigner. And somehow, it's just the one letter that changes from the E with the accent, A sound, or the S for stranger. The rest, the word is the same. So in the States, we've gotten away as language teachers from saying foreign language, but to say world language. And it's not because the word étranger or étrangère are harsh or negative, at least in my opinion. It's because of the connotation of foreign. And I think, wow, that's so important because we're all somebody's somebody else.
Absolutely.
The day we're born, we are somebody's somebody else. And as we live our lives, that will grow if we are lucky to live and to survive and to be safe. And there's another song that Pauline taught me from Quebec, and it's called Étranger, Stranger or Foreigner. And this you'll really appreciate. It says, when I was a little girl in this little village, there were the family, the friends, the neighbors, those who were like us. Then there were the others, the foreigners, the foreigner, l'étranger. There was the Italian, the Pole, the man from the next town, the poor, the beggars, the less well-dressed. And my mom, good as good bread, opened her door, rarely her heart. This is how I learned charity, but not goodness, fear, but not respect. And then it goes to the refrain, dépaysé au bout du monde, dépaysé au bout du monde, je pense à vous, demain ce sera votre tour, que ferez-vous, tomorrow it'll be your turn, you, anywhere scattered around the world, I'm thinking of you, so what will you do, what will you do? And then she talks about that it seems that the foreigners have different customs, that they have black souls, black as carbon. I surely must come from the other end of the world in someone else's eyes too. Tomorrow it will be your turn. What will you do? Do you think it's possible to invent a world where people love each other? Do you think it's possible to invent a world where people will be happy? Do you think it's possible to invent a monde amoureux, a world that will be in love, where there is no more étranger? And in all the dimensions of étranger, it's just so powerful. And Pauline Julien, who composed that, told me this was a reflection of her life. So through French, I learned this, which as a little girl somewhere, it must have been, you know, brewing in me, mijoté. It must have been. And then my path through French made me be an outsider in many, many ways.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I remember maybe 15 years ago or 20, I don't know, there was a lot of anti-French sentiment here in the States. You know, and people were, the story was people were pouring out their French wine bottles in the sewers and all that. And it was all, was political and hatred. And you think about, you know, 76 years ago, the United States and Canada and England took the risk of invading or of liberating, Americans say invading, the Europeans say liberating, la libération de l'Europe, liberating Europe. And I heard this in a podcast just last week, and the wording of liberating as opposed to the Normandy invasion, it's such a huge difference of semantics and of meaning and of power. Okay. But anyway, when you go and you meet people who have the stories of their parents or grandparents or who lived themselves through the liberation, America was so thanked by the French and by the Europeans. And that's important. It's 76 years ago now, which means that most of those people are no longer living. And it's a story to not forget, the power of stories, the power of remember. You know, the Holocaust Museum says, remember the children, tell the story, we must not forget. And that's really, it's a thread that needs to go through everybody's mind and heart as we move forward in our world. And as we try to, you know, do teshuvah to repair our world, we need to repair our world. The kids need to, all generations need to. And there's a song that I'm learning now. The only words I know of it are, Aninosea lo yodea lean lean lean, and it means I'm traveling. I don't know where. I don't know where, or to where in good English. And it's so powerful. It's our life journey. It's our lives, and our lives are touching other people. So to speak out for justice and to speak out for those with no voice or who can't hear or see or move. You know, the language, I took a photo somewhere, I don't know where I saw this, but I have it on my fridge. Love is spoken here. I've brought this and sent it to all my students. And I don't know where I saw this. It was carved on somebody's marble something or other. And this is really true. It's we are all here together. And people need to speak out and they need to listen and they need to break down the barriers so that 100 years from now, somebody isn't saying, you know, when people will live of love, maybe they will, maybe not, the children will know, but we won't be here anymore. It's the song of Raymond Lévesque, Quand les hommes vivront d'amour. And that's a song that crosses all languages and all borders. And the people that I have gravitated toward throughout my life are people who had a dream. And that's the people that I am attracted to and that I want to speak for and with. You know this, I'm sure, from Deuteronomy, you shall love the immigrant, you know? And Hagar means immigrant in Hebrew. And when I first heard the word and looked at it, I thought, I almost mispronounced it. And I thought, Hagar. And Hagar is the correct pronunciation in Hebrew. So I was incorrect at the beginning. I was, like everybody else, made an error. But the error I made was one I really think, in retrospect, one that came from really deep within me and across borders, and that is the word la guerre in French means war. And somehow there's a, you know, in my unconscious, Hagar, when I thought of that, the immigrant, and now it makes a lot more sense to me to make that linguistic connection. There is no linguistic connection.
Yeah, but it's within the phonetics, me. Yeah.
Yeah.
And we have these connections, and it's interesting how they come with experience and sometimes many years later.
Right. Yeah.
It's fascinating. But when you were talking about women of Navajo, when you were describing this thread, in my head, I pictured blank. There is no thread. I don't know why.
Oh.
Yes, I don't know why. But what?
Wow.
The connection I'm making is coming back to the point when you were talking about immigrants bringing their culture, mentality, food recipes. In my head, this blank, this is the time in my life when I, for example, speak for myself, came to this country. I brought all of Russian myself, Siberian myself, to this country. And I was living my life in the United States, but then I came to the point that I realized I have to change the mentality. And this blank thread, or whatever you call it, on the carpet of a woman of a Navajo, is the time in my life when I had to become blank and adopt American mentality, American way of living.
Wow.
So I'm just curious to see what you have to say about it. Because when we bring all our past luggage from our countries, yes, it might be a good thing and it might be not a very good thing, because yeah. I think it might be disturbing in building your life in any new country. Mm-hmm. So I'm just curious to see what your experience says about it.
Well, that's really interesting that what you're saying, Anya, gives me goosebumps, because the blank, like we could say, how big is the blank? How did it get there? Was it my choice? Did someone impose it? When I say my choice, I mean every person who is a me, you know, everybody is a moi for somebody. And I think that that's so poignant, because how do we set out to fill that blank? Are we aware as we're filling the blank? Is filling even the right word? As we are living it, as we are creating it, as we are being, are we being submissive? Are we being active? Are we aware as we're facing and creating this blank? I don't know. For me, all of my journeys, minute by minute, many times in my life, have been really unknown. I mean, I may have had an idea, but I think life was a surprise. The bad stuff and the not bad, the beautiful, all surprises, really, I think. I don't know that I had a plan for life. I wasn't raised with a plan for life or a compass or anything like that. I really didn't know. Hence vulnerability, hence my fears, hence my tears, hence my absolute ecstasy and joy. And Mana, my friend from Japan, is 8. And yesterday on FaceTime, she said, here's some of my new English words. And one of them was ecstatic. And I said, you're 8 and you learned the word ecstatic? She said, it's in my list. And she told me. I thought, oh my goodness, that's amazing. And she knew what it meant. And I think that looking for the ecstatic, looking for the beauty, I mean, those are, you know, proverbs or ideas that somebody can say, but it's really living it. And it really is slowing down minute by minute to be aware. Every moment isn't a major catastrophe or a major awakening or enlightening or epiphany, but each moment has parts of all of those. Maybe it's the yin and yang that we need to be aware that there is the balance, and that can help us when we're scared, if we know about that. I didn't when I was younger, but I do now. And I really want to be able to help people to believe in themselves and to fight for justice, not fight by hurting and taking away somebody else's justice, but to, you know, to have the strength and the wherewithal and the support to let other people live their lives justly and in peace and in safety. Mm-hmm. And I really think that we need to do that. And I think that we can, and I want to help as much as I can.
I think I see the answer regarding everything, what is going on right now with all these protests in the streets and vandalism. It's just, we are living through the historical time, no doubt. And definitely some people try to make their point and stand their grounds, and other people, they try just to take advantage of this situation.
Yeah.
And it's so bad. It's so sad to see all this.
I think we all need to have, and many people have had the experience of being different.
I like that.
It's humbling. It teaches us empathy. You know, when I took kids to Japan, they were all African American kids, and they were studying Japanese at a Chicago school. So their teachers were from Japan, and we had a trip, and I was asked to be the coordinator. And I am born here in the United States. I am Caucasian. I speak different languages. I am Jewish. I don't speak fluent Japanese. So I stood out. And I remember at the airports, and I remember on the subway platforms, people looking at our group. And I realized that I was taller than everybody else, and I was different. I was the single person who was different. No longer were the kids that I took. They were girls aged 8 to 12 or so, grade school kids. And the teachers were Japanese, and they were shorter in stature. And I stood out sort of like a tree growing in a field. And I was so aware of it. I was even more aware on subsequent trips, because I don't speak fluent Japanese. And so I was totally dependent on Nana, my host mom and close friend. I was dependent on her for everything. I couldn't understand. I couldn't speak much. I knew how to say it really fast Japanese, watashi wa nihonga ga sukoshi wakarimasu, which means I understand a little bit of Japanese. But I tell my students, don't ever say that in English real fast, because people will think you're fluent. So say it with, you know, don't don't do what I did. But anyhow, I stood out. I was so dependent and understanding and knowing where we're going. Nana would pull my arm and say, Susie, we're getting off the bus here. I had no idea. I didn't understand the announcement. I didn't know the signs. I couldn't read them. So it allowed me to have all my antennas out in terms of feelings, in terms of what I saw, my photos, my memories being so, so vivid because I didn't have language. And when you have language, you can become little by little more at ease, more comfortable, more confident. You can ask questions. We all need to ask questions. And that is the time of my life, the only time, because in Africa and Israel, I could speak, you know, and here and in France and Quebec, and I could always speak, but I couldn't with many words. And that helped me to feel like I know my students who are beginners or new here, or who have been here 45 years and have never had the opportunity to study, in quotes. That was just one of the most important realizations of my entire life. You know,
and if you would describe that experience that you had in Japan, what is the word that you would use?
Wondrous.
Wondrous.
Yeah. With my mouth just wanting to take everything in. Everything. All my senses were awakened. Because I had no voice and nothing, anything coming in my ears was a sensual music. Japanese is beautiful.
Of course.
Even if someone was, and I didn't know what they were saying. The grace, but wondrous, wonderment, amazement, astonishment.
Yeah.
And surprise. I was trained by a teacher many years ago who told us that his secret to teaching is all, there should always be a surprise. And that I was teaching French only at the time, and he really hit it on the head for me. And that's the wrong expression. What's the word? He really hit the nail on the head. See? I don't use that expression, but
which John is about the same.
Right. But it wasn't my head. But he hit it into my head. John Rassi has told us that there should always be surprise. And I know that a lot of teachers looked at him with disbelief or misunderstanding. And I thought, yeah, that's what I've done since I was 22 and had my first teaching experience. Because I want it for me. I don't want anything to be the same. I want to create. I want my students to be engaged. And if they don't know what's coming, then their antennas are up, like me in Japan. And like me in France, my first year, I never talked to people in the streets. I was quiet. I had all these sentences in my head, but I was afraid to say them, except to my French family and Françoise and Catherine. I didn't talk to anybody. I was lost, but I didn't ask, you know, and I know that's what my students feel. I know that's what they feel. And I tell them about that so that I can be real, like the Velveteen Rabbit. I can be real for them so that they feel they are entitled to be real and to go on their own journey, whether they've been here 6 weeks or 50 years.
Validating is very important.
Absolutely.
It just makes the distance between you and your students closer. Mm-hmm. And you say, basically, when you validate people, hey, I'm not any different than yourself. Okay. Mm-hmm. I always say, when I started my linguistic journey, when I started to study English, my English, I had all those stickers around my place everywhere, even in the bathroom. Mm-hmm. And they always love, because humor, that's what you want to bring
right
into the conversation as well. Mm-hmm. It's so powerful and right to the point.
Yeah,
when you're talking about having the language, in your case, you came to France first year, you have the knowledge, you have the skills of speaking French, but you did not do it because you had that psychological barrier. the same thing happened to me when I went to Ireland. And that's another story. Everybody is laughing at me because when they ask me, why did you go to Ireland after graduating your university? I said, because I wanted authentic English. And everybody is laughing. In Ireland, authentic English? Okay, tell me more. But the point is that it was so helpful for me on a psychological level.
Absolutely.
Yes, I've studied English for 7-10 years. By then, I had the knowledge, I mm-hmm. had the skills, but psychology, the brain, that's what we need to work on.
Right.
It's just wonderful. And validation is absolute my favorite, what I use, because I want them to know I was there and I know right. exactly how they feel.
Right.
This is phenomenal. This is great.
Yeah. It's, and that we all share, and valid means truthful and real and authentic, and validation is, we get that from people whom we encounter, but we also need to grow and plant that and cultivate it in ourselves so that we can feel stronger and more at ease. And it's through making contacts. It's not through isolation.
Right.
You know, isolation doesn't build that. It can't come from within if you've not had it nurtured, you know, nurtured by love and feeling like you walked part of someone else's journey. You know, we're all a stranger, and we need to remember that we were a stranger or an immigrant or a foreigner. We need to remember that. I have to tell you a funny story. The first time I went to Israel when I was living in France, I connected with a cousin who's English from Manchester, and we talked on the phone, and he said, how will I recognize you at the airport? I went by myself, and I thought, oh boy, I don't know. And I knew a little bit of Hebrew, but just a few words from when I was a little girl. And yet that sticks, proof that you should learn a language when you're little, right? But we need to plant that idea in our students who are adults and let them, I always say, you need to act like a child. You need to take this in like a child.
Which is very difficult in adult education.
Oh, yeah. Sure, when you're a pro in your professional life or your community, or you're the go-to person in your family, you're the griot, you're the wise man, it's real hard to say, you know, 1, 2, 3, and to believe that matters, but it sure does. So anyway, I told this cousin, I said, okay, so I'll be wearing a light blue coat. You'll recognize me. And I thought, okay. And nobody wears a coat too hot. So I'm walking around, and I put the hood up on my coat like I said I would. And I'm walking around looking and pulling on the hood, thinking, come on, somebody's got to find me. And everybody got their suitcases and left. And I was alone in Israel at the airport.
That's scary.
And nobody else was there. So I thought, well, you know, maybe I should walk outside. Maybe he's outside. And I go outside, I put up again on my hood, and I'm walking around pulling on my hood, looking everywhere, and nobody comes. And I thought, what do I do? And this was before cell phones. So, I mean, I really thought, what do I do? Go back to France? You know, I didn't know what to do. And all of a sudden, a man pointed to me, and I pulled on my hood, and he started walking toward me. And so I figured that was my cousin. And I ran up to him and started saying, oh, I'm so happy to see you. I'm so happy to be so relieved, blah, blah, blah. And I'm hugging him and kissing him. And all of a sudden, he pulls away from me. And I hear a voice in English saying, Susan, is that you? That was my cousin who sent the taxi driver in to find me with my blue hood.
Oh, my God. He's in the wrong man.
Poor guy. Anyway, then they started talking and laughing, obviously. But I tell that to my students all the time because they need to know. And I'm sure they've had similar experiences. They've said the wrong thing or been with the wrong person or we all have something like that. Not the same story. If we had identical stories, the world would be very boring. You know,
right,
we have
right.
to hear the surprise, like John Ressia exactly. said, the surprise, the that builds the story, it builds the memory, and it builds the lesson, you know. And I always remember that, thinking, yeah. And one last thing I want to share with you, not last maybe, but one thing, my first year of teaching ESL, it was Valentine's Day. And so I decided that I wanted, you know, I never ask if somebody has a spouse, has papers. I never ask that. If students tell, then that's fine. Then I listen, and I listen with compassion. So I didn't know. So I thought, well, I'm not going to put up something that may teach a lesson about love and romance and Hallmark cards. I'm not going to do that because it might hurt someone. So instead, I wrote a love letter to my dog, Daisy. And I put it up on the screen. I blew it up, and dear Daisy, and all the what I loved about her and all that. And then I put her photo up on a big screen, huge. So here's this little dog, Daisy, huge on the screen. And my students looked at the photo, and I said, we're going to celebrate Valentine's Day. I'm going to teach you this. Read the letter again. And then I asked them to quickly write down the first thing that comes to their mind about something or someone they love. And they had to do it really fast, not paragraphs, one or two words. And what I will always remember was a man who wrote down, I love my pencil and I love my English notebook. My first time to teach this.
Wow.
So I went from my dog to his pencil and English notebook. And it touched me so much because he was speaking love. Love is spoken here. That was a major part of his journey for justice. He had never been in a school before, grew up in a mountain village and was working here. And was new in our class and sat in the first seat, front row middle, every time. And I taught him for several semesters. He went on, he graduated with the program, but I will never forget that. And it gave me the courage and the idea to teach Valentine's Day or Thanksgiving or New Year's with that openness of you choose who or what represents this piece of Americana to you.
This is so powerful.
It's not always in a box of chocolate. But I'll never forget that. To have the power, his English, his new friends, his connection, his setting foot in a school for the first time when he was in his 40s. Man.
This is a lot. And this is a lot for you to realize. And to get inspired and motivated and see a bigger picture. This is
Absolutely.
Wonderful. And speaking about the pencils, I also learned in this country for the first time the power of a pencil. I didn't realize that the education system puts so much attention and power to a pencil. At our program, when I started, we did the first registration. I did my first registration. And when students came in, we had the boxes of pencils that we would give to the students who don't have pencils. And being from Russia, a pencil, this is something temporary in my brain because you can erase it. So we always used pens in our educational system. And I think we still do. But it was amazing to see how much power they put to the pencils, and they give a pencil to a student if he doesn't have one. And this is what this educational system does. They use pencils. I thought that was a very powerful experience for me as well. And now you mentioned the same thing.
Oh, wow. I've got goosebumps because if you don't have a pencil and you live in a system that does writing, even now with cell phones and, you know, smartphones and in teaching, our students use those. But like you said earlier, it's seeing someone's handwriting There's no comparison.
No, absolutely not.
No. You can type it, you can hit delete, and it's gone forever. You can erase something, but you know you wrote it because you still see the erasure, and you can cross it out, and it's there, right?
Yes, exactly. It just leaves the imprint in your brain, because that's what we say. To talk through things, it's one psychological process, but when you are actually sitting down and doing your homework, that's totally different dynamics and totally different mode of learning. That's why it's important to write things down. Unfortunately, we don't do it a lot, including myself. I type because it's easy and faster for me. But I think I got it pretty much clear. Your American dream is to support and guide new people, newcomers to this country. Is this accurate to say?
It's really accurate. It's from my heart and my head. And I always tell my students I want to teach to be until I'm 110. But if I have to stop when I'm 109, that's okay.
Well, and you should, because you have so much passion. And you really mean it, like you say. And you have those stories to share when you were waiting for your cousin at the airport. And this is all authentic. It comes from you, Suzanne, who really lived that and continues living this. And when we are working together, I see this passion all the time. I got your vibe, and it's inspirational. It's great. And it needs to be put out there, and it needs to be shared with your students and all people who come to this country. It doesn't matter if it's on your Zoom class or in your actual classroom or just in the street or having a cup of coffee. Doesn't matter. It's all about the energy, right? Like they say, the energy speaks before you even open your mouth. And in your case, it's clearly seen. But if you would give advice to a Suzanne who just immigrated from France to the United States, what would it be?
I would say to surround yourself, to look for and then surround yourself with people who believe in you, who help you to believe in yourself, who care, and let go of experiences that hold you back in whatever way. Let go and allow yourself to be, like you said about the Navajo rug, to be that blank space to create your journey. And it's not always easy. In fact, lots of times it's not easy and there's not a safe way. But I think finding someone who will help you, who will listen to you, who will be on your journey, that person may last for your whole life, or that person may be 10 minutes.
You never know.
And
right to the point, it's so difficult to become the blank place, sort of. And
it is.
That's the most difficult thing to do, work on yourself and let this new life to your life and build this new experiences and meeting all these people. But it's all possible. It's all possible. And I look at this as an exciting opportunity and very special opportunity to start your life from scratch in a new country and build yourself and build the life you want.
Yeah.
And I want to thank you for your being open to letting this new experience into your life. And coming back to how we met through this technology mentorship program, when I saw that you have PhD, but you were not shy to ask for help, that was a sign for me right there. I said, this is a high caliber professional, but she asks for help and support. And that's a lot. And thank you for this. Not many people can do it. And thank you for your passions. And thank you for making a difference. And thank you for being on the show today. And this is a terrific start of my Sunday. It's wonderful. Thank you, Suzanne.
Спасибо.